From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Public Health Radio presents the second in a two-part series on abortion and unintended pregnancy. On last month's show, we spoke with Jacqueline Darroch about the major research study she participated in that attempted to determine why the United States has the highest abortion rate among nearly all the developed countries. The question we'll address on today's show is whether we in the U.S. will be able to learn from these successes abroad and improve our abortion rate. So today, we'll be speaking with the chair of the Adolescent Health Policy Committee at the American Academy of Pediatrics, with an opinion researcher specializing in reproductive health, and two pro-life activists to learn if there is common ground that could unite most all Americans in the effort to reduce the number of abortions in the United States. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Following news report was compiled by Public Health Radio's news editor, Andrew Coates. The number of people in the United States who lack health insurance has steadily risen in recent years, with the most recent Census Bureau figures showing 47 million Americans lacked health insurance in the year 2006. The Census Bureau defines the uninsured as those without any form of health coverage for 12 full months, including either private or employer-based insurance, any state or military program of coverage, or Medicare or Medicaid. The percentage of the population, as well as the total number without health insurance, has risen steadily in recent years. In 2006, 15.8% of the American population was uninsured, compared to 14% in the year 2001. The Census Bureau also reported that for the first time, fewer than 60% of people obtained health insurance through their employers in 2006. In 2006, the Census Bureau noted that the number of children younger than 18 who had no form of health insurance rose to 11.7%, up nearly an entire percent. On the heels of the census report, the American Cancer Society announced that it would spend its entire $15 million advertising budget to educate the public about the adverse health consequences of being uninsured. That decision follows several recent studies consistently showing that people with no health insurance were more likely to be diagnosed with advanced cancer than people who had private health insurance and had greater opportunities to visit their doctor for regular checkups and cancer screenings. The website of the American Cancer Society is cancer.org, and the Census Bureau's website is census.gov at census.gov. Maternal mortality in the United States has been rising in recent years. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently reported that maternal mortality rose sharply between 2003 and 2004, the most recent year for which data are available. The U.S. maternal mortality rate had declined significantly from 21.5 per 100,000 in 1970 to 7.5 per 100,000 in 1984. Since 1986, maternal mortality in the U.S. has steadily worsened, and by 2004 had nearly doubled the 1984 level, up to 13.1 deaths per 100,000 in that year. The CDC attributed several causes to the worsening statistic, including better data quality and a rise in the rate of cesarean delivery. C-section delivery increases the risk of death threefold compared with non-surgical vaginal delivery and has been rising in recent years. Another possible contributory factor is the steady increase in the number of uninsured Americans, with women of childbearing age among those most likely to be without health insurance. More information is available at the website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, cdc.gov. There's a new epidemic of cholera in Iraq. The World Health Organization reported that in late August and September 2007, over 16,000 people in northern Iraq contracted cholera in the provinces of Sulaymaniyah, Kirkuk, and Erbil. World Health Organization spokesman Fadela Chaib said that 10 people had died of the illness and warned that cholera could spread further. In Sulaymaniyah province, the disease was disseminated through a water treatment plant. Cholera can precipitate profound, life-threatening dehydration within hours due to profuse diarrhea. It can be prevented by safe food, clean water, and adequate sewage systems. The outbreak exemplifies the worsening health conditions in the war-torn nation. The World Health Organization report was issued the day before President Bush made a major speech on television in which he asserted that conditions in Iraq are improving significantly. The report on cholera is available at the website of the World Health Organization, who.int. A new study by Drs. Larry Kalkstein and Scott Green was released by several environmental health organizations, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, and Physicians for Social Responsibility last week, containing new projections of heat-related deaths in the U.S. under a business-as-usual climate change regime. In other words, under current policy. The report estimates that heat-related mortality will more than double by mid-century, given the current global warming trend. Dr. Michael McCalley, Executive Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility, commented that the medical and public health communities are concerned about all the health risks associated with global warming, and called on Congress and the President to act now to minimize potentially catastrophic results. Meanwhile, the European Space Agency reported that satellite images obtained in the summer of 2007 show the Northwest Passage, which connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans along northern Canada, Greenland, and Alaska, was free of ice for the first time in recorded history. The report is available at the Physicians for Social Responsibility website, psr.org. Coming up next, Part 2 of Public Health Radio's look at abortion and unintended pregnancy. So stay with us. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The United States is unique among all the developed nations in having among the poorest indicators in the area of maternal and child health, including the highest infant and maternal mortality rates, the highest rates of teen pregnancy, and in spite of the fact that the United States has the most active anti-abortion movement among all the developed countries, year after year, among every social stratum, the U.S. has the highest rate of abortion. On last month's show, Jacqueline Derrick joined us to describe reproductive health policy in the other developed nations. The key features that appear effective in reducing the number of unintended pregnancies are easy availability of contraceptive services to women of all ages, greater use of the more effective contraceptive techniques, especially oral contraceptives, universal access to medical care, usually without cost to the user, better integration of contraception into primary care practice, and comprehensive reproductive health education in schools. When it comes to abortion, Americans are quite divided on how easily women seeking to terminate their pregnancy should have access to abortion services. I spoke with Tom Smith from the National Opinion Research Center. Smith is one of a handful of nationally recognized experts on Americans' behavior and attitudes in the area of reproductive health. I asked Tom Smith what the breakdown is in Americans' attitudes toward accessibility of abortion services. Smith first discusses Americans' attitudes toward access to abortion by teenagers, especially if their parents are unaware of the fact that they're seeking to terminate their pregnancy.
Generally, Americans believe that parental consent should be required for teenagers to have abortions, but a majority also want to create a safety valve, which basically says that in a dysfunctional family where they can't turn to their parents, they can turn to someone, usually a judge, who can then give them the approval. So they're not, therefore, parental consent with a safety door for teenagers is basically what a majority of Americans favor. They also, of course, favor that pregnancy should be avoided, and there's a substantial number that want the teenagers to seriously consider adoption rather than abortion as the alternative, something that, again, I believe is promoted more by U.S. policy and law than is typically the case in Europe.
Do most Americans want, say, medically safe abortion to be available to people over age 18?
They want it to be available but not encouraged. A majority of Americans believe that there should be a legal right to abortion, but a substantial number of supporters of the legal right to abortion believe that it is still morally wrong and say they would not take and use abortion themselves. For certain reasons, like the mother's health being endangered, nearly 90% of Americans support abortion. Matter of fact, you can divide Americans up into three groups, somewhat simplifying the thing, but basically it goes as follows. Only 10% of Americans are absolutely against abortion and will not approve of it for any reason. 30% believe that there is an absolute right for abortion and approve of it for any reason as long as the pregnant woman wants an abortion. That leaves 60% of Americans in the middle. They support abortion, access to abortion for certain reasons at a certain time during the pregnancy, but not for all reasons during any time during the pregnancy. So that's where the majority of Americans actually fall. They actually fall on this issue that we all often see as a very polarizing issue. Only 40% are in the absolute never pro-life or whenever it's wanted pro-choice camp. 60% are conditionalists.
So clearly Americans are quite ambivalent about abortion, and virtually everyone on all sides of the issue would want to act to reduce the number of abortions. I spoke first with Mary Bearworth, executive director of Vermont Right to Life, and Eileen Haupt, a member of their board of directors, about what strategies they advocate to reduce the number of abortions.
Well, I'd like to start by talking about state legislation. There's been research that's been done that shows that state legislation has an impact on the reduction of abortions, like, for instance, parental involvement laws, informed consent, Medicaid funding, and, you know, the partial birth abortion ban, which has been, there's been a lot of states who have enacted that. The one that for the youth, the one that shows, actually for both the youth and for older women, the one that shows the that has the most impact is the Medicaid funding restrictions. But parental involvement for teens also has an impact, and you know, Vermont has none of these, so or they don't have restrictions on Medicaid funding. So we're not doing anything as a state that I can see that would actually reduce the number of abortions.
They would also eliminate government funding for Planned Parenthood, an organization they feel actively encourages teen sexuality and abortion. But those strategies apply only after the unintended pregnancy has already happened. If these strategies are successful, then teenagers who have an undesired pregnancy would be more likely to keep the pregnancy. But of course, teen pregnancy has far worse outcomes than pregnancies begun later in life. And even in the event that a healthy baby is born, the child-rearing skills of most teenage parents is quite limited, especially when the pregnancy is something that was neither intended nor desired. Furthermore, in Europe, Australia, and other developed countries, which all have lower rates of abortion, the strategy of restricting access to abortion by those who are already pregnant remains in place in only a few countries. Instead, the far lower abortion rates throughout the developed world result from policies that decrease the likelihood of unintended pregnancies from happening in the first place, and not policies that discourage abortion once a woman has already become pregnant. So I asked Mary Bearworth and Eileen Haupt what strategies they would recommend to prevent pregnancy in the first place.
What works best is promoting abstinence and delaying sexual activity. Right in the Guttmacher data itself, you'll find that abortions are lowest in the heartland states of America, with a more traditional culture of honoring marriage, discouraging premarital sex. Those states that have implemented abstinence education have seen a reduction in the abortion and in the teen pregnancy rates.
But it turns out the situation is a little more complex. Bearworth is correct that states in the heartland of the U.S., where religion is a more important component of daily life, have lower rates of unintended pregnancy and abortion. Tom Smith's data support that point.
There is some evidence that goes along the following lines. And here there's a what I would call an indirect connection rather than a direct connection to what you just said. If you have intact families that are actively practicing a religion, those two facts together, religious practicing family, intact family, will tend to have teenagers who are less likely to engage in early sex and less likely to become pregnant as a teenager while unmarried. Now, I want to emphasize they are less likely, but still a substantial number of children of such family will still become pregnant, become sexually active, and so on. But there is those who come from broken homes, those who come from homes in which there's no religious being practiced, those teenagers are more likely to take and have those situations develop. So it's not an all or nothing, but there is a level of difference that does appear.
On the other hand, once kids are in middle school or beyond, abstinence-only education has not proven effective. I spoke with Jonathan Klein, head of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Adolescent Health, about what high-quality impact studies have demonstrated about abstinence-only education programs in the schools.
Recognize that the evidence for the abstinence-only programs is really quite conclusively bad. It doesn't work, and if anything, some of the programs in that area result in worse outcomes, not better ones. And that in order for us to realistically address effective prevention, it's going to be important that we be honest about that data and that we provide a balanced abstinence plus reproductive health information and services approach to what we promote to our young people. So that, I think, it reflects sort of where the current political discussion is. But right now we have a set of abstinence-only programs which have written into their law a variety of things that don't reflect the sexual norms of adults in the U.S., much less teenagers, and which put the clinicians and the families in an increasingly difficult position of wanting to help young people act responsibly and having to address the misinformation from some of those campaigns.
I returned to Tom Smith, the public opinion expert, and asked him what the American public actually supports on the issue of sex education in the schools.
Right. The first thing one has to say about sex education in this country is it's very complex because it's very diverse. We have a decentralized educational system in which the majority of educational decisions are made by states and by local school boards, local superintendents, and so on, and not like it is in most European countries where there's one national educational policy that applies uniformly throughout the country. So that's the first complication. Now, in terms of the public, 90% of Americans favor sex education in the schools. Two-thirds to three-quarters favor what I think you would fall under your description of a comprehensive for middle school and high school students. They are much less likely to favor it for younger students. So, again, it's not that the majority of Americans are opposed to such instruction. A minority is, and it's partly that opposition from that minority that has limited it, and it's partly the very diffuse, decentralized structure of education in general and sex education in particular that has hindered its widespread uniform adoption.
So the United States has a far higher abortion rate than the other developed nations. The single most important feature of reproductive health policy in every one of these countries is widespread availability of quality contraceptive services. I asked Mary Bearworth from Vermont Right to Life about her organization's position on contraception.
There are a lot of pro-life perspectives. I mean, there's every imaginable pro-life organization in this country. Black Americans for Life, Gay and Lesbian Alliance for Life, Priests for Life, Nuns for Life, there's a number. But the Vermont Right to Life Committee takes no position on contraception. Our interest in preserving unborn life and restoring a sanctity of human life ethic begins at that moment of fertilization where science places the beginning of human life. But we stress, most importantly, abstinence.
And Bearworth is quite clear on what she feels teen health practitioners should tell their teenage patients.
And I would go one step further and really recommend that every pediatrician and every obstetrician who sees a young teenage girl who says, I have not been sexually active, that they say, instead of saying, as they are wont to do here in Vermont especially, if you need contraception, come and see me or go to Planned Parenthood, but instead to say, congratulations, young lady, you are making some of the wisest decisions for your health, and we congratulate you on not being one of the crowd, because someday you're going to be very glad. This is good for your health. No morality, no religion, just good for your health. So there's many, many steps we can take. I think the United States is on exactly the wrong track to be doing what you hope to do, which is reduce the impact on the healthcare system and reduce the number of abortions.
But Jonathan Klein, the doctor who specializes in adolescent medicine, finds the situation in the trenches treating actual teen patients to be quite challenging and feels that one single approach is not likely to succeed. I asked Klein what position the American Academy of Pediatrics takes on this issue.
The position of the Academy is that all adolescents ought to have information about their sexuality and their reproductive health, and that all parents should be given some anticipatory guidance about speaking with their teens about responsible sexuality, and that teens who choose to be sexually active should be given accurate information and accurate services to allow them to prevent pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. But I think what's really important from the perspective of a pediatrician who's involved in care of adolescents is that we really have the appropriate focus on prevention and on appropriate reproductive health services so that adolescents have both the knowledge and access to the health care they need to be able to prevent pregnancy whether or not they choose to have sex. If we're going to make sure that young people have all of the information that they need and all of the services they need to be able to make responsible decisions, that includes making sure that they have reproductive health services as well as information, as well as that family values piece. So the issue of sort of who is the patient, I mean, you know, for most parents, they've chosen the teen's clinician, and they have a relationship, and they've done it because they think that the pediatrician is able to help them guide their teen around health and development. And so what I find and what many clinicians find is that parents want you to be able to address the issues of not just sexuality, but substance use and other safety issues and mental health issues in the primary care setting. On the other hand, many young people don't have good access to care. And the other part of that is, of course, that some of the health services around sexuality are protected in most states for teenagers, so that if you're able to understand what the risks and benefits are, there's often a way for young people to be able to get those services, whether or not their parents are receptive to them being able to receive them.
Most parents would probably want their teenage children to delay sexuality as long as possible, but they face a significant challenge.
Well, again, I think the issue is that the values as to whether it's appropriate to have sex as a teenager or not are up to individual families to talk about. The reality is that almost 50% of high school students report having had sexual intercourse, and a fair number of teens report having started to have intercourse by age 15 or 16. So that whether or not I personally believe it's appropriate for young people that age to have sex or not doesn't change the fact that most of those teenagers have decided to do that without the benefit of my having spoken to them about it. Since they're not necessarily seeking information or consultation about the decision to become sexually active, I think if we then have a choice between whether that set of choices leads to pregnancies or sexually transmitted diseases, that it's critical that we make sure they have information to be able to make their choices in a safer manner rather than to have those outcomes. You know, generally, in the U.S. at least, very few teenagers ask their parents whether they should start having sex. That doesn't tend to be a decision that teens consult their parents on. And my perspective is that it's much better for the teen to be able to demonstrate that they've decided to be responsible in protecting themselves or their partner, whether or not they've made that decision. So that there aren't too many parents who can't hear both of those messages, and you know they might have preferred that their teen not start to have sex. On the other hand, they'd rather that if their teen decided to do that, that they were acting responsibly. But I think it really depends on the individual teen and their family and sort of how that comes to the parent's attention. And I'd say it's fairly rare that parents will raise the alarm with their clinician.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's airing is the second in a two-part series on unintended pregnancy and abortion in the United States. On the final portion of today's show, we'll look at public opinion on contraception, the role of adequate health coverage, and a comparison of the public health systems in the U.S. compared to other developed countries where the abortion rate is much lower. So stay with us. Thank you. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's show is the second in a two-part series on abortion and unintended pregnancy in the United States. On the first show, Jacqueline Darroch joined us to review the many reasons why the rates of unintended pregnancy and abortion are so much higher in the United States than in any other developed country. In the U.S., some major demographic segments of the population emphasize abstinence as the exclusive approach to dealing with teen sexuality. On the other hand, in other developed countries, teen pregnancy has a much greater social stigma than does teen sexuality. This leads to greater use of contraception, particularly the more effective hormonal contraceptive methods. In addition, there are no financial barriers to care present in any of the other developed countries. This improves access to care by young women in those countries to all forms of primary and preventive care, including contraceptive services. On today's show, we've discussed these issues with two activists, members of Vermont Right to Life, with Tom Smith, a leading national expert on public opinion and policy in the U.S. related to reproductive health, and Jonathan Klein, a pediatrician active in the practice of adolescent medicine and chief of the Committee on Adolescent Health at the American Academy of Pediatrics. The goal of today's show is to determine if it is feasible in the United States to implement some of the successful strategies used in other developed nations and lower our very high abortion rate. We left off with Jonathan Klein discussing his flexible approach to adolescent health, tailoring his care to the specific needs of each teenager, and able to provide comprehensive reproductive health services ranging from reinforcing abstinence to assisting sexually active teens with contraception. So far, we've heard the thoughts of Right to Life activists on the issue of contraception and the thoughts of a doctor who specializes in adolescent health. Next, we'll return to Tom Smith, the reproductive health expert at the National Opinion Research Center, to learn about what beliefs the public at large holds about contraception. I start out by asking Smith what attitudes the American public holds toward contraception for adults.
Well, in terms of adults, there is wide level support for both the distribution of information about, the availability of, and the actual use of contraception. It really only becomes controversial when we talk about minors, about teenage populations. Although some religious groups in the United States still have positions against the use of contraception, this no longer reflects the actual practice among adult Americans. And as I said, it's really only a issue of major controversy in terms of teenagers.
And I'd like to ask you how one really knows this. In other words, I assume that there are nationally representative surveys, or how is it known? Are, for example, the Catholic Church has taken strong stands against contraception. So are there surveys of American Catholics, or and do American Catholics differ from other countries? I guess the question I have is the quality of survey research to an attitude towards sexuality and on sexual behavior. What do you think of the quality of data?
Right. Okay, let's take and split that. Attitudes and behavior, and let's talk about behavior first. There was this very good study of women of childbearing age called the National Family Growth Study, which has been done since the 1960s. If you go back to the 1960s, Catholics were much less likely to take and use methods of birth control, artificial birth control as it's sometimes called, that were not sanctioned by the church. By the 1970s, the difference had begun to disappear, and by the 1980s and down to the present, there is absolutely no difference in the use of birth control in general and of unsanctioned methods such as the barrier devices, the oral contraception, between Catholics and non-Catholics in the United States. Although the Church's position has not changed on contraception, it is a battle that the Catholic Church has completely lost, and Catholics are no more likely to shun the use of birth control than anyone else's, and the vast majority of all Catholics do during their periods of fertility when they're trying to restrict family creation, do use unsanctioned birth control methods. Now, in terms of attitudes, there are questions that ask people about whether, you know, whether people should use it, whether information should be available, whether such devices and such information should be available to teenagers. And here we have data going back into the 1980s. And what is, I think, particularly surprising, there's a question that we've asked since 1986, which says whether you agree or disagree that birth control should be available to teenagers 14 to 16 years old who are sexually active but whose parents object to them having access to contraception. For the entire period, 1986 through 2006, a majority of Americans have agreed with the availability of contraception to those teenagers, even having posited parental objection in the question.
You pointed out that the majority of Americans, a national sample of presumably American adults, would want sexually active teenagers to have, even fairly young teenagers, 14 to 16 years old, to have access to contraception, even if their parents wouldn't want them to have it. And I guess I have a few questions about that. When you poll parents who are against having their sexually active kids use contraception, do you have any insights about how they realistically expect their child to not end up with a pregnancy?
Well, okay, here you get into the major thing is a significant group of Americans who, in terms of sex, as in terms of drugs, believe in the just say no. They believe the proper response to avoiding teenage pregnancy and, of course, other problems such as sexually transmitted disease is virginity. And that if you start to provide information about birth control and about other things, that you're starting down a slippery slope in which you're undermining the moral principle of virginity before marriage. That is a minority of Americans that take that position.
How small a minority is that?
You can measure it in some slightly different ways, but a kind of general number that would apply to this is about a third of Americans would lean in that direction, and at least a fifth of Americans would be kind of more adamant. In other words, they would a certain percent would say, well, yes, we virginity should be taught and contraception shouldn't be provided to teenagers. But if you push them a little bit, they'll say, well, yeah, if they're already doing it and, you know, if the virginity standard has already fallen, I'd rather have them safe than pregnant as a 14-year-old. A smaller group, as I say, about a fifth, are so strong in favor of the virginity-only approach that they don't want to take any steps to approve of or support the use of contraception.
Once parents have teenage children who are sexually active, is it known whether those children would be less likely to become pregnant if their parents strongly encourage them to use contraception? Is that known for the U.S.?
Well, what we know is both for individuals and on the aggregate level for countries, the higher level of contraceptive use among teenagers leads to fewer pregnancies and as a result to fewer abortions as well. Those results are well established. Now, it gets a bit complicated in that, for example, the contraceptive use has to be diligent. You can't just take and use it sometimes. Like teenagers will take and sometimes use it not with their steady partner, but with an occasional hookup. Well, that's better than nothing, but that's not really the way to avoid pregnancy or STDs. You have to take and be much more consistent than even most teenage users of contraception usually are.
One of the interesting points we discovered on the last airing of Public Health Radio was that one of the many reasons why teenagers in the United States are much more likely to become pregnant is their much less likely to use contraception than teenagers in most of almost all the other developed countries. And based on the interviews of Jacqueline Derrick's study, parents in the United States are much more likely to worry their children are going to become sexually active, and when they see, say, their daughter going out steady and becoming very infatuated with their boyfriend, they start to undermine that relationship, often successfully. So they often succeed at undermining a steady relationship that teenagers may have, driving the kids apart, and they end up having more different sexual partners, finding another boyfriend, getting jealous of their former girlfriend, say, and just having sex with maybe the next girl who comes along. And it tends to be unprotected sex without use of contraception. So her data show that children in the U.S. are likely to have not more frequent sexual activity, but more different partners. And I was wondering what, based on the experience you have with your survey research, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's several differences. There's difference between the United States and most European countries, as you've alluded to, first of all, in attitudes. Not in all European countries, but particularly in most of the Western European countries, parents are more accepting of teenage sexuality. And second of all, there are structural differences. The actual access to contraception, and particularly reliable contraception, such as oral contraception, is much more restricted in the United States than it is in European countries. So those two factors together leads to the higher level of unintended pregnancies. In terms of parental intervention, it may well work, as you've indicated, but unfortunately I don't know any particular research that really addresses whether the parental intervention tends to be counterproductive or not.
Some of the data from Jacqueline Derrick's study show that of sexually active couples, regardless of their age, the 10% of couples who are using no form of contraception end up accounting for half the abortions. So the implication is that contraception is actually pretty effective overall. I'd like to ask you, does the public believe that contraception is effective? And when they don't use contraception, is that a reason? Or what are the types of reasons?
Well, I mean, I think adult Americans realize that there are many forms of contraception which are highly effective in terms of preventing pregnancies. There are others that are highly effective in terms of preventing STDs, and there are some that are reasonably high on both, but you do have to separate those two. Oral contraception, of course, providing no STD protection, but a very good, excellent level of prevention of contraception. What you said about the 10% of teenagers who don't use contraception at all, accounting for a very high proportion of abortion, that's not only because, of course, they're more likely to get pregnant, but one of the reasons why those young couples are not using contraception is that they're not able or willing to approach their parents or someone else to get contraception. They know that their parents would be so object to them having a sexual relationship that they can't go to them and say, you know, I need to get on the pill, Mom, or I need to get an intrauterine device. And it's that barrier to the first step of getting protection which leads them to take and get an abortion because their parents aren't going to accept them being mothering or fathering an illegitimate child.
Do you think that there are characteristics of the healthcare system in the U.S. compared to other countries that may discourage use of contraception among teenagers or even adults here in the U.S. compared to in other developed countries?
Well, what exists in many Western European countries is the public health authorities believe they have not only the right but the obligation to directly intervene with teenagers and supply them with the public health care needs that they require, including contraception. In the United States, there is a much greater belief that parents have to be the determining factor, and public health officials should not take in, intervene independent of authorization from parents. Now, that has pluses and minuses to those differences. In other words, there are in the United States greater parental rights. That can be considered a good thing. But there's also a greater barrier or greater difficulty to serve the health care needs of the teenagers themselves because the United States recognizes a greater role of parents.
Jacqueline Derrick points out that in Europe there is a publicly promoted by government and private sector organizations, a publicly promoted ethic or attitude that says teenagers should not become pregnant. And avoiding pregnancy is primacy. That's the goal. They're not coming out with as strong a statement as to whether or not children should have sex, but they're saying, look, if you're going to have sex, you're damn well not going to become pregnant. So there are public messages right on the media that say those things. That's the social message. The healthcare system is expected to get that to happen. And in the U.S., it's more ambiguous. There may be more of a message that, well, I don't know about contraception. A lot of people may not even think it moral. You pointed out that's a minority. But taken together, I think most people would say they're not getting that message, that the prime issue among teenagers is they ought to not catch a disease and ought to not get pregnant, as opposed to ought to not become sexually active in the first place. And what are your thoughts on that issue?
Well, again, yes, in the United States, the do not become pregnant message is not the first line message. It is that teenagers should delay becoming sexually active, ideally until they are adults and married, but certainly the emphasis on delaying it. Then the next line of messages are to avoid both STDs and pregnancy. And I think STDs perhaps get more of an emphasis. In some sense that makes a lot of sense because pregnancy will happen to the female partner. STDs will happen to both partners, and therefore the at-risk population is twice as large there. And partly because I think there has been more of a concern about not only STDs, but of course HIV as the deadliest STD in the United States than there has been in Europe. So yes, there is a different emphasis, not only in which pregnancy is only one of two health messages that the United States emphasizes, and the moral issue, which is basically ignored in Europe, is given much greater weight in the United States, that young sexual relationships not only have health concerns but create emotional and psychological problems is a theme that is prominent in the United States and, as far as I know, is essentially absent in Europe.
So at the end of the day, when you've reviewed the data showing that the rates of unintended pregnancy and abortion are so much higher in the United States than they are in all the other developed countries, what is your analysis of that, and what do you think ought to be done to change that and to improve those data?
Well, the first thing to say is there is improvement. The level of teenage pregnancy and the overall level of abortions has been going down in the United States. They are still, of course, as you've rightly pointed out, much higher than is typical in other similarly advanced, well-developed countries. And there seems to be a need for more public health messages getting across, more information about avoiding pregnancy, about contraception, to further reduce that. But we are at least moving in the right direction, but with a long way to go.
Do you think that those who develop public policy in government are accurately reflecting public attitudes toward contraception and preventing pregnancy, say for teenagers, in the U.S.? Does our policy reflect public attitudes?
Well, the problem is that the attitudes are diverse enough that if there was a strong, high level of public consensus on all these issues in the United States, as there appears to be in many European countries, then the policies would be more like the European policies, and they would have a stronger public health component. While the majority of the Americans' attitudes in terms of access to contraception and support for sex education, as you say, comprehensive sex education, while the majority of Americans support that, there is a substantial minority, and public policy has tried to modulate its position to take and reflect both the majority position, but without going as far as the majority position would take them, out of respect for the minority position.
So overall, do you feel fairly optimistic that we will reduce the abortion rate in the U.S. over the next decade?
Well, the abortion rate has been going down. It's still high. Again, we can talk about general abortion rate or teenage abortion rate. We're still talking about millions of abortions each year, so it's not like it's vanishing. But in terms of the absolute number of abortions and in terms of the abortion rate, that is, proportion of pregnancies that end in abortion, both of those have decreased in the last 10 years. It's not a rapid decrease, but it is a movement in that direction, which, as far as I can tell from looking at the figures, are likely to continue in that direction.
And the main reasons for that?
Actually, it's pretty complex. One is greater use of contraception, which is reducing that. Some of that is an unintended side effect. For example, among teenage populations, the biggest increase from the 80s to the 90s and then into the 2000s was increased use of condoms. Condoms were use increased, not so much to avoid pregnancy, although that was part of it, but their increase mostly came from a concern to reduce STDs. So the attempt by teenagers to avoid their own exposure to STDs led to the fortunate side effect of less unintended pregnancies. So there's more use of contraceptions among both teenagers and adults. You also have the adult population is actually a portion of women of fertile age is actually aging in the United States right now. Both the greater maturity and the decline in their fertility is leading to less pregnancies overall and less unintended pregnancies as a subpart of that.
Well, Tom Smith, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Very good.
And thanks to our guests from earlier in the show as well. Reviewing what we've learned about reproductive health policies in the other developed countries and public opinion in the United States, it seems that the strategies that have been used elsewhere in the developed world that have successfully reduced the number of unintended pregnancies and the number of abortions are actually supported by a solid majority of the U.S. population. It seems that the obstacle to change is therefore political. Those who oppose greater access to contraception and who oppose a flexible approach toward adolescent health care and comprehensive reproductive health education in the schools have played their cards well in the political realm. Those who wish to change the approach our schools take and our doctors are using will need to be politically astute, get involved with your local school, improve access to comprehensive health care by supporting universal health care coverage, improve access to effective contraception, including emergency contraception, otherwise known as the morning after pill. Listeners who would like to learn more about these issues should access the website of the Alan Guttmacher Institute, which is guttmacher.org. guttmacher.org. It was my grandmother who first spoke to me of the importance of investing in an ounce of prevention, and in no policy area is this more the case than in the prevention of unintended pregnancy and abortion. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.